Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1, action.
Assume nothing.
Rash, bald-faced blasphemy.
Question everything.
I find it extremely hard to imagine.
Open your eyes.
It is quite all right to be an atheist.
The fastest growing group of people in the country has been measured as being those who have no belief or who are atheists.
You don't have to be apologetic or quiet about it.
Challenge the opposition.
You see religion on 100 fronts losing the argument.
And start thinking. This is The Thinking Atheist Worldwide.
Coming up here in the month of June, I think probably the third week, I'm going to have a conversation with a soap opera star. Oh, yeah. Daytime television fans are going to love this one. Actually, his name is Scott Clifton. You may know him better on YouTube as an atheist activist under the moniker Theoretical Bullshit. Scott Clifton is an actor. He's been on like General Hospital, and currently he is an actor on The Bold and the Beautiful. So he's in Los Angeles and he's on a soap, but he's also got a YouTube channel, which was one of the first that I had discovered when I was coming out of my own faith. And he actually made some pretty good arguments. He's engaged people like Matt Sklick and William Lane Craig, and he's an interesting and very entertaining guy. And so anyway, he's going to join me for an audio/video podcast later on in the month of June. That'll be a first for me. Soap opera star on my show. And the guy is really smart, and he's got so much good stuff to say. Our paths crossed in Los Angeles when I was out there for the event with Matt Dillahunty and Cara Santamaria, and I was like, I've got to get you on the show, man. So anyway, I have a soap star coming. I'm also thinking I might release the audio from a presentation that I just did this last weekend for the Northern Ohio Freethought Society. They were having their annual celebration and invited me out to participate. But my speech was, I called it, I Lost My Soul on Twitter. And it's sort of a variation on a bigger speech that I'm writing for later on in the year. But it talks about how it's, you know, it's not enough for us to be right. I mean, we're engaging all the time. And we engage because we feel like we are on the side of right. I know exactly how that feels. You know, you plead the case, you make your point, you produce the evidence, you sit there and hammer away day and night on the keyboard because you think you're right. I know the feeling. But how productive are we? How effective are we? God, if we're out to change minds, how can you and I be effective? Well, there is a resource that I would encourage you to check out. It's a lecture series at The Great Courses Plus by Dr. David Zarefsky. It is called Argumentation, the Study of Effective Reasoning. That's the key word, effective reasoning. I hesitate a little bit because if you say the word argumentation, most people just think arguing, like hammering at your keyboard on social media. And that's not what we're talking about when we speak about formal argumentation. In the big picture, this is about presenting our claims, supporting and defending the claim, trying to be persuasive, and helping somebody else hear and possibly adopt what we're trying to present. And that's why Dr. Zarefsky's lecture is so helpful, because it teaches about effective and ineffective language and logical fallacies and differences between arguments on a stage and a discussion over coffee. And most importantly, how can you and I be effective out there when we are trying to persuade people? Argumentation, the Study of Effective Reasoning. Check it out. It's just one of over 10,000 lectures at The Great Courses Plus on a ton of different subjects, streaming into your life anytime you want, on your computer, your laptop, your TV, your smartphone, or via their podcast app. As one of my listeners, you can get started right now with a free trial with unlimited access to all of their lectures, but you have to use my special URL. Show your support of this show, explore any topic that interests you, and sign up for your free trial right now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. FYI, after I finish talking to Chris Matheson, my special guest here on the broadcast, about his book, The Trouble with God, A Divine Comedy About Judgment and Misjudgment, after we speak, I'm going to go back and actually read a chapter out of the book for you right here on the radio, so you can get a taste of what the book is and have something more to listen to. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's coming up after I speak with Chris Matheson. Now, Chris is probably best known for his film work And we talked about his book, The Story of God. But Chris, I just want you to kind of give your own background. I'm sure you can do a better job of fleshing it out for the audience in case I have some new listeners I've picked up. Who are you and what do you do?
I've been a movie writer for a pretty long time. My best known movies are Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And a number of other movies over the years, including a little movie called Rapture Palooza, which kind of plays with the idea of the rapture occurring and the aftermath of the rapture. And I wrote a book called The Story of God in 2015, which kind of takes the Bible from Genesis to Revelation and tracks him, follows him throughout, and tries to make sense of his strange behavior. And now I've written a follow-up to that where I'm following him out of the Bible and into the other books where he appears.
God is a great source for comedic material, is he not? I mean, I guess we're talking in this case about the Christian God, or do you go broader? Is it more like the everybody's God kind of thing?
I think it's the Abrahamic God is a tremendous character. I think from his first appearance in the Old Testament, he's really, really hilarious because his behavior doesn't make sense from the start. It's kind of self-hating and self-destructive and sometimes seems very foolish and disorganized. He's very funny in the Christian narrative. He kind of disappears. His son sort of takes over, but he makes a grand reappearance in the end in Revelations. And boy, he's really hugely funny there. I think he's really funny in the Quran. You have to look at it in a certain way because the Quran's kind of forbidding in a certain way, but that he's coming back and wanting to try again, I guess because he's failed. I don't know why he thinks it's going to work this time, but he tries again. And then he makes just a really, really spectacular appearance in the Book of Mormon. It's more than an appearance. I mean, he's back. He's big, you know, he's a big star. He's back and better than ever. And he's hugely funny there. And he's even funny in a really obscure esoteric book called The Book of Urantia. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or you don't want to read it. It's awful. It's ostensibly the Bible written by aliens, very superior space aliens. It's brilliantly funny. It's so horrible. It's like it's really
wait,
long.
Wait, hang on. Is this written straight? Like, did someone actually buy this or?
Oh yeah. Yeah, back in the 1920s, this guy in Chicago, and they never name him, right? Because they don't want to name him. They want to act like it came from these superior space aliens. But it's just kind of some businessman in Chicago. He just started channeling, right? He just started going into trances and talking. And somebody wrote it down, and that is the Book of Urantia, supposedly written by these aliens about the whole big story.
Holy and so shit. He's
yes, great. Oh, it's great. Well, it's bad, but you know, you have to be to love this stuff. You have to be kind of a connoisseur of bad in a way, and I am.
It's like the Mystery Science Theater of literature. You go in with that. Well, I'm sorry, you're talking. I had to pull up. There's a freaking wiki page on it. Urantia book, sometimes called the Urantia Papers, a spiritual and philosophical book that originated in Chicago. The origins unknown. They don't name an author. I'm going to have to get into this.
You'll love it. And it's crazy as you get into it. Well, the versions of the biblical stories are insane. You know, like Adam and Eve are like 8 feet tall and they're green and they can fly and, you know, it's madness. And then it's super racist. It's crazy racist. It's just all about the inferiority of certain color. You know, anybody who's not white, essentially.
Wow.
It's really, really grotesque, but wonderfully funny.
I'm coming back to the Abrahamic God, the God of the Bible specifically.
Yeah.
I know the purists are already gone, but God was an awful character, and they talk about, you know, the child murder and the raping and slavery and all that stuff. But between those lines, I mean, God does have this weird thing, an omniscient creature that is always surprised. You know, it's around going, well, shit, how did that happen?
That's
a strange result. That's unexpected. And of course, you're like, you're God. How can it be unexpected? And that's kind of the tack you take, I know, with the story of God quite a bit. Tell me about the new book.
Well, I finished the first book and I loved him. You know, I'm a comedy writer and I just thought this guy is just, he's the greatest comedy character ever created. He's so delightful and so ridiculous, and I'm not done with him. I want to keep going. How do I keep exploring this guy comedically? Because he's, you know, as a comedy writer, really the gig is you try to find a character. That's all it is. You're just kind of, you're searching around, looking for a character, looking for a voice, and then you go, oh, right, got it. And he was really fun to write, and so I wanted to keep going. So I finished, and I thought, well, how can I continue? And then, you know, the little obvious light bulb went off over the head. It's like, well, the guy just reappears. He's back. He comes back in the Quran and he comes back in the Book of Mormon. And therefore, I'm going to just follow him into those books and try to make sense. And this, and it gets even more kind of Byzantine and peculiar his behavior, because trying to stitch all of these books together into one logical kind of coherent narrative, like this guy makes sense, it was, you know, it took a little time to try to piece it together, but it was fun. He's a really, really fun character, as you said, the guy who is all powerful and is so often surprised, and not just surprised, infuriated. Yeah. Infuriated. Like, I did this. Yeah. This game that I set up and I always lose. It's just, it's magnificent.
It's funny. I was talking to my friend Armin Navabi. He is from Iran, a former Muslim. We talk about the Quran, and I found the Quran, even more than the Christian Bible, I find the Quran almost unreadable in its, it's just, and I'm like, is it me or why is this so hard to digest? Why is it so hard to get through? And Armin said, you have to read the Quran like you would read a Trump tweet. And I'm like, you know, that's some of the best advice. You read it in short bursts. Yeah. And, you know, you then you can go and shake your head for a while and then come back and read the next section. Did you do a lot of Quranic research as you were getting into it? Or did you go verse by verse for a while? How did you approach that?
I just dug into it, and I'll tell you what I found. I mean, you're right. It is difficult. It is forbidding. I think he's writing it in a consciously sort of lofty, imperious kind of way, and it's only Muhammad's voice. You don't get that great variety of voices that you get in the Old Testament, which makes it, you know, you get a range of different voices, and some of them are really good writers, and some of them are really bad writers. But it's kind of, it changes gears. The texture changes, and the same in the New Testament to a different degree, different voices. The Quran's just him. Okay. It's just him. And he's got a very chilly, sort of voice, which deliberately so, I believe. It's also not narrative. There's very little narrative in it to the degree that there is, it's really a lot of scolding. I mean, the Quran amounts to behave or be punished again and again and again and again and again. One iteration of behave, believe in Muhammad or be punished again and again and again. So that gets pretty old. And where there is narrative, he's just kind of reframing biblical stories. But those are pretty funny. You know, when he retells the stories of creation and the story of Adam and Eve, and talks about Moses and talks about Jesus and his version of Jesus is pretty funny. But I would say what intrigued me at a certain point, what I find fascinating is it's like detective work with these guys, right? They're trying to hide themselves. They're trying to act like God wrote these books. They're trying to cover their own fingerprints. They're trying to act like it's not them. And once you kind of, you start sniffing him out, then it gets really kind of interesting, the detective work of finding him, because it is ultimately so self-serving. You know, it is God basically commanding people to obey Muhammad, even to the point of like telling them what to do when they go to Muhammad's house for dinner, you know, giving them very specific directions of like eat quickly and then leave afterwards and don't bother the prophet, you know, that kind of thing. which is wonderfully trivial for the creator of the universe, in my opinion.
I find the Old Testament the same way. It's, I mean, of course, I'm exaggerating here, but it's always like, you know, get two goats, face one of them to the east, slaughter one of them, send the other into the wilderness, you know, stand on one foot. There's all these weird requirements, I would think, that, you know, the creator of the universe seems awfully pedantic about.
Oh, no, they're great. I mean, and I especially, you know, and his really, his demands for how the temple has to be are just so delightful. And they're so kind of like,
I'm like, God, what the hell is Shittenwood? What is that?
And like, he's got such sort of flamboyantly like Liberace taste, you know, it's like, I want pomegranates and I want gold balls and I want incense and I want this kind of wine, you know, it's bizarre. It's like, okay, he finally reveals himself. And he's really kind of queenie, which I think is super funny. I love
talking
that.
Here with the author Chris Matheson, who has the new book called The Trouble with God, a divine comedy about judgment and misjudgment. I know that after The Story of God came out, I don't know, do I call it an addendum? Do I call it a PS to that book called Satan's Story?
Yeah.
Where you sort of came back and looked at it through the eyes of God's arch nemesis. But in this book, you referred to Satan as his frenemy. And I'm like, look, flesh that out. I mean, how do we approach the character of Satan?
He's a fascination, isn't he? Yeah. He is the strangest character in the whole story by a very wide margin. Because what on earth is he doing there? Why is he there? And if God's all powerful, and of course God's all powerful, because the story doesn't even make sense if he's not all powerful. Obviously he's all powerful. So why did he make him? Why? As his first act, pretty much, or one of his very first acts, because, you know, he's there, he's the serpent, like really early. Why did he create his own worst enemy who would foil him at every turn, right at the beginning? What is the logic of that? And, you know, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that, except that there's, on some level, I think he needs to be seen. I think there's a weird Kafka-esque or, you know, Dostoevskian kind of quality to this character of God. He needs to be known. He needs to be seen. He has to be recognized. It has to be seen by someone that he's insane or a fraud or delusional or bad. Someone has to call him on it. And in that sense, Satan is necessary. And Satan is the one who can get through to him and does again and again and again. Yeah. It's really fascinating because I've been reading, you know, some of the Eastern stuff, you know, the Buddhist stuff. And they don't have a powerful, like, devil character, like Mara, who is the devil character, who shows up to sort of, you know, ostensibly torment the Buddha, is the lamest devil of all time. I mean, he's the feeblest. Can I curse on your show?
As much as you want, please.
Okay. He is the feeblest motherfucker of all time. He just shows up and he's like, I'm going, you know, twirls his big black mustache. He's like, I'm going to get you, Buddha. You'll never escape me. And Buddha invariably just looks at him and says, go away. And he just scuttles away. That's it. Like, that's the extent of what Mara can do. He's utterly feckless and powerless. But that's not Satan. Satan's really got the ability to mind fuck God, and he does it. And that question, that fundamental question, where did he come from, I think is unanswered and fascinating and very rich.
Have you noticed in pop culture, especially in film, I think, have you noticed that Satan gets all the best lines? Like, Satan is always the most interesting character, and then Yahweh, God, Jesus, deity, is usually just some sort of white light that shines in through a window with a harp gliss in the background. I mean, it's a nameless, sort of faceless, good power that shows up at the end, but you never really sink your teeth into it. Meanwhile, Satan's been chewing up the scenery for 90 minutes. You catch that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he always gets the good lines because he gets the God is stuck in the position of, I am pure good. You know, bad things happen, but I am pure good, and you may not question that. And Satan gets gets to question that, and Satan gets to poke at that. And I mean, John Milton nailed it in Paradise Lost. I mean, Satan's everybody who's ever read Paradise Lost, everybody kind of falls for Satan, because Satan's fascinating, because he's like super dramatic character, because he's exciting, because he's vivid, because he's tormented, because he's very rich, because any actor on earth would want to, Daniel Day-Lewis would want to play it. Who the fuck would want to play God? What is there to play? There's nothing to play. You're just pure good. Okay, if you really dug into it, you know, like my interpretation of him, yeah, there is. He's insane. You know, he's insane. He's self-hating. He's an absolute disaster of a being. But that's not how he's portrayed. Satan's you know, the bad guys always get the best lines anyway. In an overall sense.
Well, my buddy Lucian Greaves up at the Satanic Temple, of course, they take it, you know, pretty far. But I like the fact that they use Satan as sort of an icon to represent rebellion against tyranny and the challenge to authority and all those things. And I totally buy that. In that instance, you know, Satan is kind of a useful icon. It has, as he would say, great utility for challenging authority and rebelling.
Again, and I didn't come up with this idea, but if you go through the Bible, and I think even more so if you added the Quran and the Book of Mormon, if you stack up all of the deaths, all of the kind of brutality that is done by God to mankind, and then you put the violence towards mankind that is perpetrated by Satan, okay, it's crazy one-sided. You know, what is it exactly that Satan's responsible for Job's kids being corrupt? What is it exactly that Satan does that's so bad? All he does is he questions God. All he does, and the Book of Job nails it. The Book of, if there is one thing in any of these books that is essential, that is absolutely essential to getting the gist of all of these characters, it's the Book of Job. Because the Book of Job reveals God as the lunatic, the cruel, irrational lunatic that he is, and it gets Satan as the sly kind of he's Bugs Bunny and God is Elmer Fudd, basically.
That's a great visual. That actually brings it home for me. Chris Matheson. All right. To wrap up our short conversation, just kind of give me a plug for the book for those who are interested in it. I'm going to include the link, of course, in the description box and encourage everybody to go out and pick it up and support it. But I mean, just sort of give us the brochure for it real quick before I let you go.
If you are fascinated by the character of God and find the idea of getting inside his head and traveling with him on his journey of incipient madness and destruction, then I think you might enjoy my new book, The Trouble with God.
Incipient Madness would be a great podcast name. I mean, I'm just saying.
I can just yes, it would.
That over here.
Yes, it
Chris
would.
Chris Matheson. The book's called The Trouble with God, a divine comedy about judgment and misjudgment. Chris, if I believed in God, I would say you're going straight to hell.
Oh, dude, and I'm so going to hell.
There's a great t-shirt that says, I'm going to hell in every religion. And I feel that way in every day of my life.
Totally.
Chris Matheson, good stuff. I appreciate your time and best wishes with the new book. All success, my friend.
Thanks, Seth.
Coming up in just a second, I'm going to read from the book, The Trouble with God. We'll get into chapter 14 and give you a taste of what Chris Matheson and I have been talking about. It's coming up next. Chris Matheson is author of the book, The Trouble with God, a divine comedy about judgment and misjudgment. And I just had a conversation about the book. Let me read from the book with his blessing and permission. We'll get into chapter 14, which says this. At a certain point in the writing of the Quran, God had started to wonder if maybe he was slightly overdoing it on the punishment side of things. Maybe it'd be a good idea to talk a little bit more about the reward side, he thought. God decided to describe to Muhammad what good people could expect at the end of their lives, other than the unspeakable joy of knowing that everyone else was burning, eating cactus, and drinking boiling water. Ha ha. Granted, there wouldn't be very many good people in the end. Hardly any, really. Like 0.1% of mankind, maybe. But still, for that tiny little minority of human beings that never, ever doubted God's perfection, and God frankly doubted whether such people even existed, for them there would be paradise. Life in paradise would be marvelous, God informed Muhammad. People would wear lots of jewelry. Their clothes would be silk, and they would lounge around on couches and carpets, murmuring peace, peace to each other, while sipping sparkling wine, non-alcoholic, needless to say. By the way, there are references to the Quran in all of these little phrases. There would also be, and this is where God had surprised himself, at least at first, big-eyed virgins, lovely young maidens who had never been with either man or genie. Women who'd had sex with genies were extremely slutty, in God's opinion. Why would anyone sleep with a genie, he had repeatedly demanded. These virginal young maidens would be available to the men in paradise for eternal lovemaking, God informed Muhammad. Question, would the lovemaking be procreative? Is that how you say procreative? Procreative? Yeah. No, obviously not. God didn't want a bunch of screaming babies in paradise. The maidens would have to be fixed so they could never get pregnant. God remembered stopping at that point and mulling over what he had just written, feeling frankly confused by it. This makes no sense, he thought to himself. I hate sex. I always have. Why would I want it in paradise? Then, in a flash, God understood. Of course, he exclaimed with a broad smile, the virgins are a temptation. He decided to go one step further. I will also surround those few good men in paradise with handsome lads. And again, he cites the verse in the Quran. Only the ones who decline to have sex with those nubile youths will get to stay in paradise, he mused. God loved to imagine a man who'd comported himself perfectly in life and just arrived in paradise. There he sat, reclining on a couch in his brocaded silk robe, sporting a chunky silver bracelet and drinking non-alcoholic wine and feeling pretty damned great about himself, until he looked at one of those perfectly formed boys and thought to himself, at last, my eternal reward. But the moment he touched one of those eternally firm buttocks, guess what? He would find himself plunging straight to hell. If anyone thinks there's going to be homosexual hanky-panky going on in paradise, they've got another thing coming. God had yelled loudly to no one in particular. And if you're wondering whether maybe those beautiful boys would be in paradise to tempt the ladies, well, the answer to that is no. And here's why. Because there wasn't going to be any ladies in paradise. Who would it be? God had sometimes demanded of Gabriel. I mean, seriously, who? Eve, who instantly disobeyed me? Sarah, who laughed at me? Mary, who doubted me? Lot's wife? Noah's wife? Honestly, who? The truth was, God had informed Muhammad that women were like fields, meant to be plowed. Thinking back 500-plus years, God realized that Paul had been absolutely correct when he'd said that women were literally incapable of understanding truth. That's from the New Testament, 2 Timothy 3:7. And that is why I told Luke that only men were holy, God crowed proudly. Eventually, God decided that he might allow one girl into paradise, Jephthah's daughter. It's not that he felt guilty about what had happened to the girl. Obviously, he did not. Remember, she was burned as a human sacrifice by her own father as a pleasing offering to God. A deal was a deal, after all, and the girl needed to be killed in order for her father to defeat the Ammonites. Still, God couldn't deny that at certain moments, thinking back on watching Jephthah murder his poor crying daughter, yes, it did bother him. I will allow Jephthah's daughter into paradise, God had suddenly announced one day. Why, I might even learn her name at some point. As for those eternal sex bots, or whatever you wanted to call them, as soon as God was done with them, he destroyed them. He certainly wasn't going to allow them to drift off and start having sex with genies. He dashed their brains, which were tiny anyway. What did they need brains for? He dashed their brains out on rocks. Near the end of the Quran, God began to have some very puzzling second thoughts about, well, basically everything he'd just written. The Jews and the Christians were completely wrong about things, he told Muhammad, but still, didn't they believe in the most important thing of all? Him? Did he genuinely want them punished for all eternity? Non-believers, yes, definitely, they were beyond any hope. But other God-believers, weren't they, in some sense, the best of his created beings? Mightn't they go to paradise too and live there forever? Then God had found himself softening even more. Even to those who didn't believe in him, why not just say, "You go your way and I'll go mine," he asked. Quran 109:6. Why did people have to fight about this stuff? So they disagreed about things. What was so terrible about that? They could think different things, even pray to different gods and leave each other alone. Why can't you all just be kind to each other? God asked mankind. Quran 90:17. And with that, as well as a few brief threats against one particular man and his wife, the man who would have to be burned, his wife would have to be hung, God was done. "I will never have to speak to mankind again," he thought to himself at that moment with supreme satisfaction. "That is wonderful." He experienced a brief moment of blissful calm. Then, grotesquely, that devilish inner voice whispered to God, "Are you sure?" "Be silent," God instantly responded. "Who says they're free of doubt except the man who is plagued with it?" "Enough." "Who forbids questions except the man who is terrified of them?" "Silence, doubt." But doubt, it was by now rather obvious, could not be, could never be, completely silenced. Chapter 14 of the book by Chris Matheson, The Trouble with God as He Gets Into the Quran. That's fun. Finally, we skip out of the Christian Bible and get into the Quran and some other holy books talking about the trouble with God. I'll include that link in the description box of this broadcast if you're interested and want to pursue it any further. And I hope you have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you back here next time. Take care.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. Watch dozens of original videos on The Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. And visit our website for resources, links, contact information, the editor's blog, and more. TheThinkingAtheist.com.